Okay, from time to time, I would like to do what I would call a guided dialogue. I would like to ask you some questions, and just as kind of plenary discussion group, I'd like to get comments and responses from you. In order for it to work well, there are a few guidelines. The most important is speak loudly enough so that everyone can hear you. Project your voice so that I don't have to constantly repeat or ask you to repeat. I'm getting a little harder hearing as I get older, and that would be a favor to me. And then secondly, as we go back and forth, when we do these guided dialogues on various terms, I really want you not to do too much censoring. It's most fun if you don't try to give a profound, balanced, incisive answer, but to some degree, say what comes to your mind. It really tells us more about where we're at in terms of our beliefs and values and so on. And also, when we go back and forth, if there's any discussion back and forth, this is never to be taken in a kind of personal sense. I take very seriously the fact that as a teacher, it's never appropriate to put a student down, to treat you rudely, even though I think it's part of my responsibility as a teacher to be as tough-minded as I can when we're dealing with ideas. I don't have respect for teachers who have a therapeutic model that just anything that anybody says is just fine and dandy. I think that's really patronizing, and it's much more effective in terms of learning if we try to think as clearly and speak as honestly as we are able. So I'd like to throw out several terms and get us thinking together about them and then see where we go. Another ground rule, since the process of discovering the meaning of these terms is just as important in some ways as the conclusion, if you're, say, a grad student philosophy major or even an undergrad philosophy major who has done a lot on moral theory and so on, or if you're one of the TAs, I would urge you not to get involved right away in the discussion. Just let the thing pass by, because if you immediately come up with some very sophisticated answers on these questions, you short-circuit the process of discovery, which is really important. So let's have some fun together. Be sure to project your voice, and let's see where we go. The first term, and Greg or Rob, would you, Greg, you've done this before. Why don't you come up and get some stuff on the board for us so we can see it. What comes to mind when you hear the term value? Just without a lot of censoring, just jump in. Yes?
Immediately mass marketing. Maybe it's mass marketing.
Mass marketing, okay. Okay. Good. Others? What comes to mind? Value. Yes? Nice and loud.
Worth.
Okay. Value. Yes?
Priority?
Mm-hmm.
A deeply held belief, like we have about like a value for honesty.
Okay. Deeply held belief? Mm-hmm. Value. Yes.
Something taught.
Something taught? Okay. Mm-hmm.
Personal and cultural values?
Personal and cultural values. Okay. Others. Value. Yes?
The degree to which something can be used, or for how many different uses it has.
The degree to which
something can be used.
Okay.
And how many different uses it has.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Value. Okay, a second question. Can you know whether a value claim is true or false, is right or wrong? How many of you think you can? How many of you think you can't? Okay, about half of you aren't committing yourself. That's okay. Let's talk about that. Some of you think you can't know whether a value claim is true or false or right or wrong. Why not? nice and loud.
Value is based on a personal belief system.
Okay, values are based on a personal belief system. Okay. Others. Yes.
I think that in a certain sense a value claim is always true because it's coming from someone, and that's, if that's their value, then it's always going to be true for them. But to say ultimate truth, or is it true within society and what we want, then you have to judge if that person's values go along with it.
Okay, it's always true for you. Okay. Yes. Nice and loud.
I think that there can be some universal values. Like, it's wrong to murder is universally wrong. And there could be a variety of reasons for backing that up, but that's what I'm just saying. That is. Or the worst of genocide is always wrong. Like,
okay. Okay. And there are two different points of view. Others. Can you know whether a value claim is true or false? Yes.
Well, in the practice of marketing, it's what results will be. I mean, if something has value, then something's going to want it.
Okay, in marketing and in a market economy, it what depends on whether people buy or not. Or okay. Incidentally, also one of the ground rules. As long as you're not sleeping, as long as you're thinking, don't be afraid of silence. It's okay sometimes just to sit and think for a minute. Others, can you know whether a value claim is true or not? Tamara?
Well,
nice and loud.
I think insofar as we can actually know anything, there are value claims that we can know are true or false.
Okay.
Proving them.
Okay. How do you prove them? Others, can you know whether a value claim is right or wrong, true or false?
I have a question. What would be a false value claim? I'm trying to think of
what would be a false value claim?
Yeah.
Okay. Let me test you out on a value claim. How many of you know that it is wrong for any human being, to torture any other human being just for the hell of it? And I add the proviso, just for the hell of it, because you could conceive of a terrorist having put a thermonuclear bomb in downtown Manhattan. You have 6 hours to find it to save 10 million lives, and you might conceivably resort to torture. How many of you don't know that is wrong? Amazing. This is the first class I've had in 30 years. Or, no, I've been doing this about 25 years. Where there aren't some skeptics on this. That's astounding. Greg, what's happening? Yes?
Well, it also values judgments very often across cultures. I mean, some cultures, like if you go to a third world country where there's someone in the world who's torturing people every day, they generally don't think because they're valid. They think it's a true value judgment.
So are they wrong?
Not just self, but to me.
What do you think?
I think they're wrong.
Do you know they're wrong?
I don't know they're wrong.
How many of you know they're wrong in that case? How many of you don't know they're wrong? Okay, this changes the picture a little bit. How come you don't know that's wrong? Seems pretty obvious to me. Yes?
It's just a subjective thing. Like you say, it's something different to each person, so how can one person, you know, say, oh, well, you're wrong, whereas that can't just be reciprocated and the other person to, well, I think you're wrong. You can't ever come to a decision on that.
Okay. There were some other hands. Yes?
I think that...
Nice and loud.
For, at least in my mind, the part that makes me not be able to really answer that question is the clause that you put at the end. For no particular reason. Because how can you know if that person has a reason? And how can you judge whether that person's reason is...
I sort of added just for the hell of it, just because you're bored or don't have anything better to do, just passing the time of day. Just, not too precise. some people operate by the wrong set of morals. Sorry?
Okay,
yes?
I have to disagree that a fact is universally accepted. many facts are just based on one's own personal experience. So to say that the earth is twice the weight of the, or the sun is twice the weight of the earth, that kind of, a lot of people, they would have to have seen that themselves or experienced that themselves before they really accepted that fact.
Okay. I had a headache this morning, a sinus headache. Most of you probably don't know that. Now you may know it if you believe I'm telling you the truth. But certainly not universally accepted or known. Other thoughts?
I've heard of that true virtue as something that just hasn't yet been disproven.
Okay. Some people talk about falsifiability. Biologists seem to love that, especially, although most philosophers argue that you don't need to set up scientific claims in a way that they can be falsified, because it's almost as hard to falsify something without auxiliary assumptions as to prove it. Yes?
I don't think you have to experience something to believe that's a fact. You just have to hear it or read it or learn it from the source that you find credible.
Okay. That's interesting. Any other thoughts on this? This was quite interesting that most of you did not want to commit yourself that the sun is at least twice the mass of the earth. That's really quite remarkable in terms of saying you knew that as a fact. Yes?
I think the facts are basically relative. The same. Everything we can perceive from here, looking at the sun with all the measurements and stuff, some looks to be twice as different from the but we don't know what it looks like from the sun to the earth to them, and then we check the opposite looks from there. It seems to be relative to the environment or where you are.
Okay. We know some things are relative. Certainly Einstein, in terms of speed of light, in terms of time and relation to speed, there's some relativity here. Yes?
I think it also depends when we think about it, whether we trust someone else's word based on whether we think they have the same motivations as we do. In other words, we wouldn't distrust Newton or anything like that, but we think they're trying to fool us. But
okay.
If you look at, let's say, a historical event, people could perceive the exact same happening very different eyes.
And we see this all the time. You're driving down a road on a dark, rainy night, and at first the road seems to curve to the left. And you get a little further, and thank goodness you see that it actually curves to the right, and so you do a quick mental adjustment and don't go off the road. How many of you are surer of the truth of this claim, equals mc squared, than you are of the truth of the torture claim? Gary?
Well, there have been so many processes that show the heat of mc squared in terms of nuclear bombs and
okay.
All that sort of thing.
Which is more universally believed, the truth of the torture claim or E equals mc squared? The torture claim. Okay, let's move on, and then we're going to come back to all of these. Our third term, we're running out of space, I'll put it up here. What does it mean to know something? What does it mean to know something? Yes?
Be
absolutely certain about it. Okay. Others, what does it mean to know something? Yes?
To be educated about something.
To be educated about something. Okay. Others? Yes.
Absence of doubt.
Okay. Yes.
Have a concrete experience of something.
It is a real favor to me when you speak loudly because my hearing is fading with age. Way in the back. Yes.
To find an explanation for something that fits with our preconceived social construct.
Find an explanation for something that fits with our preconceived social constructs? Okay. Yes?
Familiarity.
Familiarity. This is often one definition of knowledge. It's extraordinarily complex, and we still don't really know how the brain We don't know in detail how the brain recognizes faces. Facial recognition is pretty complex. And yet, we have familiarity, and we know that this is Susan or John, or this is my wife, or this is my child. In fact, do a little experiment. This is very interesting. Take a pen or a pencil, close the pen up, and use it for a moment as a probe. Don't poke your neighbor with it, but use it around the edge of your notebook or around the edge of the chair. Close your eyes. Close your eyes and use it for a moment as a probe. Like a dental probe. You just feel, or just feel around your arm with it, or around the chair or something. Okay, now open your eyes. This is a very mysterious business, because the mind plays an incredible trick on you, because if you, you obviously are not literally feeling anything with the distal end of the probe. This is, has no nerves and so on. But your mind tricks you into thinking that you're actually feeling with that. And if you, even if you put it on an inanimate object, not on your arm, it's as if you're feeling with that. But all you're actually feeling is different pressure and temperature sensations in your fingers and wrists, different muscular toning and so on through your arm and shoulder. We have no clue how the mind does that. That's a very mysterious business. And if you use the probe, try it again for a moment. Close your eyes and focus on the proximate sensations. Focus on what you're really feeling, your shoulder, your wrist, your elbow, the temperature changes, and the probe is useless. It doesn't give you the kind of information by which you, or for which reason you use the probe. Now, there's a familiarity in this. This is what Michael Polanyi sometimes calls tacit understanding. There's a kind of knowledge, just like you don't have any serious doubt when you see your mother or father or most of your close friends about who they are. There's a familiarity, but you don't really know how the mind does that. That's another interesting kind of knowledge. Okay, any other thoughts on what it means to know something? Is knowledge really certainty? How often are you really certain about what you know? Some who haven't gotten jumped in yet. Does knowledge equal certainty? Or are facts things that have been proven beyond doubt? Admitting that there's no new medical cure for this, some fine adhesive that puts it back together, or what is this fancy stuff they did in Star Trek and so on, you know.
It's always worked today. Right?
It's worked today, yes.
I think everybody's been said that you drop your pen, so drop and grab me.
Yes, except that the men, that the pen is made out of metal and you have some powerful magnets. Certainty is a very interesting concept. Was I certain when I sat on this railing here that it would hold me up? How many of you think I was? How many of you think I wasn't? okay, I was not theoretically certain that this would hold me up. There might have been one of you who had heard me lecture on this in another class, and you thought you once show me up, and so you came and saw the post almost through and then covered it over with some paints and tape, and you know that if I sat here, it would collapse. I'm not theoretically certain of that, but do I know that I can sit on that and it'll hold me up? Yes, I know that, and I'm willing to risk making a fool of myself by trying it. Let me take an extreme example. How many of you are theoretically certain right now that you're awake? Okay, I'm not certain I'm awake. You may wonder yourself. But I can remember in my early childhood, before antibiotics, I would sometimes get a high fever in the early 30s and would start hallucinating. And I talked to people who've been on LSD and certain mind-expanding drugs, and they told me they reached a state where they didn't know whether they were awake or hallucinating or what. I am not theoretically certain right now I'm awake. It's conceivable that some of you drugged my coffee and while I wasn't looking, and that I'm in sort of a trance state on autopilot right now. But if you ask me, do I know I'm awake? Of course I know that. If you ask me, do I know the sun is at least double the mass of the Earth? Yes, I know that. Now, what is knowledge? What does it really mean to know something? Is knowledge theoretical certainty? If it is, do you know anything at all? Yes, we are in the corner.
I think you kind of made it sound like knowledge is like an educated guess, like having to do with probability. It's seen and experienced a lot of times before. And that's why when people go through life.
A little louder?
That's why when people go through life, they experience things and they gain knowledge, but they might not gain certainty.
Okay. Other thoughts on knowledge as certainty or something else? Yes? Practical certainty. Maybe you've read Aristotle. Aristotle talks about phronesis, which is a kind of practical wisdom or practical certainty. Others, what does it mean to know something? Yes? Nice and loud.
You know, like our Monaco turns 98.6 degrees Fahrenheit.
Yeah.
Well, it's 98.6 is useless about Fahrenheit. So okay. It's like you go to absolute zero, but temperature. There's like an absolute zero
certainty
that you have to
get to.
Okay.
Okay. Let me give a little historical background here. The philosopher Descartes, would you put his name on the board, please, Greg? He argues, he did a very famous experiment, which some of you, a thought experiment, which some of you have undoubtedly heard of. He said, I want to try to find a sure basis for truth. And the way to do this would be to doubt everything I could doubt. Just systematically to doubt everything that I've been taught, and then see if after all the acids of doubt have done their work, if there's anything left over that would form a sure basis of my knowledge. And so Descartes doubted everything he could conceivably doubt. And then one day as he was thinking about this, he had a kind of eureka experience, a kind of epiphany, and he said his famous cogito ergo sum, or you might have been thinking in French, what je pense, non je suis, I think, therefore I am. And he said, this I really can't doubt. This is just indubitably certain. I cannot doubt this knowledge claim. And he said, this I will take as certain and now construct my philosophical edifice on this foundation. But it wasn't long before other philosophers came along and said, Mr. Descartes, you really didn't quite do what you promised, because if you had doubted radically, thoroughly, you would have had to doubt the grammatical, the syntactical validity of the French and Latin in which you did your doubting. And of course, had you done that, you would have been totally paralyzed. And what philosophers have pointed out correctly, I think, is that no truthful human thinking, no effective research program, no effective living can start with radical doubt. All human thinking that's at all fruitful inevitably starts with a belief or faith or assent rather than radical doubt. Now, just reflect on this for a moment. In the very learning of language, if you have a young child and she comes to you and holds up your coffee mug with a question in her eyes, she's just learning to speak, and she wants a name for it, and you smile and say, "Oh, an alligator." And she can't quite say that. She tries a few times, and just about the time she gets it, she goes on to something else. But the next day, she holds it up again, and you say, "Oh, airplane." And then maybe the third day, just for variety, you say, "Coffee mug." What would happen to the child? She would be paralyzed. She would never learn to speak as a human being, and she would never learn to think as a human being, because human thought is intrinsically, inevitably related to language. So the very act of learning to speak and think as a human being is necessarily related to a prior commitment to the social context, the people around you, to tell the truth. You can't learn even to think or speak unless people tell you the truth, generally. Yes?
What about like problem-solving skills that don't necessarily involve any form of, you know, linguistic thinking?
Most human problem solving does involve language, although admittedly some animals do simple problem solving, crows and other animals, mountain gorillas and so on. But I think even that's pretty far down the line, because if you can't even talk, it's not clear how much problem solving you're going to do as a human. An infant does some problem solving. The baby quickly finds the mother's breast and knows how to suck because it's probably built in genetically. But what I want to call to your attention is that you cannot start with radical doubt. If I got up this morning and asked, "Am I certain, am I theoretically certain that my food is safe to eat?" I would have had to say no. Because I remember that last fall I plunked somebody in 407 and they were quite angry about it. And I noticed yesterday that I saw this student walking up and down the road in front of our house with a very strange look. And I left the back door unlocked. Maybe he came in and poisoned my food. So I say, okay, I won't eat my breakfast. I could lose a few pounds anyway. I'll get on to the office. And I'm just ready to turn the key in the car, and I say, "Whoops, maybe it wasn't the food, maybe it's a bomb under the hood." So I decide to walk to work, and maybe it's a bomb connected to the door. If you demand theoretical certainty, you will die. You will not survive. Almost none of what we ordinarily base our lives on is theoretical certainty. But it is knowledge. Now, what do we mean then by knowledge? Knowledge, it seems to me, is much sooner what we might call a justifiable belief or a warrantable assertion. Knowledge is a claim for which you can give good reasons. Now notice what that does if you if you redefine knowledge away from theoretical certainty, where we are theoretically certain about very little, but we know a great deal, every day we entrust ourselves to elevators and automobiles, and we walk through doors without too much worry about bombs and so on, although a little more than before 9/11. But we have theoretical certainty about very, very little. Now, if you define knowledge as a warrantable claim or a justifiable belief, why doesn't it make sense to say you know that gratuitous torture is wrong? Because clearly you can give good reasons for that, can't you? Yes.
Pardon? You just made knowledge evaluated. So what's good or what's justifiable?
Of course. And is that a bad thing to do?
No, but that's why you can't say you know. Because
why not? Why shouldn't knowledge be value laden in the sense when a scientist makes judgments about experimental outcomes and so on? This is value laden, isn't it? This is a better reading than that. This is better data than that. Yes?
Even like if you have a fact that has been proven, it doesn't fit into value to you or believe it.
Okay.
So like, you know, some people like to say it at least has been proven. Because then there's some people like when they decide something they won't believe it.
Okay, and you have cases like there was a time when the French Academy of Sciences decided that meteorites couldn't exist. It didn't fit their latest theories, and so they insisted that all of them be taken out of the museums. And fortunately, the curators were more conservative than the scientists, and they just stored them down in the basement. And then 20 years later, when the scientists changed their minds, they brought them up again. Hypnosis was initially rejected by scientists. Tectonic plates wasn't very widely accepted at first. These would be examples. Yes?
I feel like there's a big difference between...
Nice and loud?
There's a big difference between, like, acceptance and, like, knowledge. It's just because some people don't accept that, you know, like, torturing is wrong. Like, and they think that way. Like, does that necessarily mean that, like, we don't know, like, you know? Like,
okay. Does, which is more widely accepted? Clearly, the E equals MC squared is much less widely accepted than the torturing. We know of no society ever in human history, and from what we can gather from prehistory, that has permitted gratuitous torture of members of that society. They sometimes define people outside the society as subhuman, and they had a human sacrifice, which was not gratuitous. It was to propitiate the gods and goddesses and so on. But no society ever has permitted gratuitous torture. No society ever has permitted willy-nilly lying whenever you wanted to, and so on. These moral principles are far more universal than anything in science. And we can understand that, because had a society permitted gratuitous torture, they would have self-destructed. Had they permitted lying whenever you wanted to, they wouldn't have survived. So isn't it, if we define knowledge as justifiable belief, does it not make sense to say you know that that kind of gratuitous torture or that kind of thing that Hitler did and so on, that you know those are wrong? Why would you not know those were wrong? Because you have very, very good reasons for believing those to be wrong. Yes?
I disagree that no society is. Female circumcision or foot binding in China, and, you know, we believe that I believe that those are forms of torture, and yet these societies accept them.
Of course, but they did not think it was gratuitous. The very point is, we may think that some of those practices may be not good, but for them, these were not gratuitous. The moral principle involved is not whether everyone agrees on the particular practice. different societies have accepted slavery, but eventually in the Western world, slavery was abolished much earlier than in other parts of the world. But in the cases you give, these are not gratuitous. When the Aztecs, for instance, sacrificed virgins to the gods, this was for a very real purpose. We think their purpose was wrong, but it was not torturing someone just for no reason at all.
But wouldn't our society say that, say, you know, those examples are gratuitous violence?
No. If we did them today, you might think of that differently, but in our society today, almost always when someone does things like that, they do them for a purpose. Now, we may say that the person is mentally ill. People who are mentally ill do some very, very strange things. But it's still, the point is that, if you can show me that, I'll be very, very impressed, because I have never seen any credible example of any society that has said you can go around bashing people just for the hell of it, for no reason at all. And it's pretty obvious, even animal groupings don't allow that, because they wouldn't survive.
But Hitler doesn't finish that example, then.
No, Hitler had very good reasons, and I think he thought perhaps were good, although we don't know what went on inside of his head. He may have realized he was a scoundrel. But at least publicly, he gave reasons for killing Poles and Jews and others. It wasn't for choice.
So then when you're judging the, judge them for being wrong, right? Because it's not gratuitous.
No. When I say there are certain moral universals, this clearly does not mean we agree on everything. There's all kinds of moral issues where we disagree. There are issues today in our society like abortion, and or even different kinds of abortions. Most Americans think that partial birth abortion is an obscenity. Many Americans, probably a majority, think that abortion under some circumstances is morally permitted. So there's lots of moral disagreement, just like there's lots of scientific disagreement. But there's also an incredible amount of moral agreement, because if there weren't, we actually could not live together.
So is it the majority rules then with
morality? No. And this is one of the issues that we'll look at carefully as the term progresses, just like the majority doesn't rule in science. You don't vote on scientific experiments. You don't vote, or I don't think you should vote, on most moral issues. You give good reasons. Now, the question, what constitutes a good reason, is a very tough issue. That would seem, and in some ways it does, push the question of relativism one step deeper. What is a good reason and what isn't a good reason? And the reason that we have apparently more agreement in science and less unending disputes is the term science, as we use it, is a value term. When we say science, we mean good science. We mean science the way it's done at Cornell and Harvard and Chicago and Stanford. We don't mean astrology. We don't mean Lysenko. We don't mean alchemy. We don't mean bad science. We mean good science. And so within the realm of good science, we have protocols for adjudicating disputes. The difference with the moral community is we have a plurality of moral communities. Catholic theology, Marxist ethics, secular humanist thinking about morality and human beings. There's a huge amount of overlap among different moral communities, but there are distinct differences. Yes?
Mm-hmm. It seems to me there's a difference in morality and culture, and that with culture we don't always have to have a good reason for what we believe, but sometimes you let that override the morality.
Okay, there are large areas, and maybe this is what you're including in the term culture, where we allow for different tastes, different interests. The foot binding, that had reasons for being done. Most of us today think they're not very good reasons. On the other hand, something like circumcision, there, male circumcision at least, many people still practice it. There are many disputed issues, but notice that the radical dichotomy between fact and value, that value claims are personal and subjective, or one can be true for you and the opposite true for you, that doesn't work very well. Because if you think of knowledge as justifiable belief, we have extraordinarily good reasons for believing much of what we believe in the realm of morality. Can you imagine what kind of a society it would be if you could go around bashing people whenever you felt like it? You wouldn't have society. You would have chaos. So we have a very good reason and set of reasons for believing that kind of social arrangement is wrong. But does this, am I getting through it all? I'm trying to undercut the easy distinction between fact and value. As one writer has put it, there are no uninterpreted facts, or all facts are value-laden. What you consider facts is dependent to a very large degree on what you think is worth knowing. Close your eyes just a minute. How many of you know for sure whether my glasses have a metal frame or not? Or whether they're just a plastic around instead of metal? How many of you know that for sure? One. Two. Oh, three. Okay, open your eyes. There's not a metal frame around most of the glass, although there is some on the top. That was a bad example. I could have given you other examples. Now, why wouldn't you have noticed? I sometimes, when I'm wearing a tie, I ask how many of you know for sure whether I'm wearing a tie class or not. And only a handful know that. Well, you don't know that because it's of no particular interest to you. You see what you're looking for, you hear what you're listening for, to an amazing degree. Knowledge is usually value-laden. And moral claims are usually closely related to factual claims. And we'll talk about this through the semester. These are very, very interesting interrelationships. But what I'm trying to get you to think about this morning is that the simple division between fact and value doesn't work very well. In one sense, as one of you pointed out, all knowledge claims are personal, in that if you don't accept the claim, it isn't effective for you. And in another sense, value claims can be just as objective, I would argue, as scientific claims. And we'll explore this later in terms of trying to redefine the terms objective and subjective. Any last thoughts or questions at this point? And at this stage, I'm not trying to resolve these issues so much as just to get you thinking about them. They're wonderfully interesting issues. But most of you, I think, in your generation, even more so than in mine, from a very early age have heard that value claims are subjective and personal, and scientific claims are objective and factual. And what I'm trying to do is to demythologize that belief somewhat and help you see that if factual claims have to entail certainty, we know virtually nothing. And on the other hand, that there are many moral claims about which we have virtually no doubt at all, and where it makes good sense to say we know they're true. Any last thoughts or questions? You all look very serious at this point. Yes?
I'm just a little turned around with what you said earlier, that morality didn't go along with the majority.
That it didn't. Right.
You said, you don't vote on science.
Right.
So there's a little band of morality and everything
comment, and we will come back to that, because it is true in a society, and I think this was seen in the former Soviet Union, that if you stray too far from where the majority of people are, it becomes a very unstable social situation. So majority and minority make a difference, even if, as it does to some extent in science, but it's not necessarily a decisive difference in terms of how you argue for this scientific claim or this moral claim. There, I would prefer to see it in the realm of reason, and what kind of reasons you can give for this claim is over against another claim. But we'll come back to that. That's a wonderfully interesting comment, because if there's too much of a discrepancy between where the majority is and where the minority is, you have a pretty unstable situation.